The following content has been provided by New St. Andrews College in Moscow, Idaho. For more information, visit us online at www.nsa.edu.
All right, the Westminster Confession of Faith, Chapter 9, of Free Will. So Chapter 9, Paragraph 1. God hath endued the will of man with that natural liberty that it is neither forced nor by any absolute necessity of nature determined to good or evil. So then, by virtue of creation, mankind was given a true and natural liberty with regard to all issues of good and evil. Okay? True and natural liberty. This is Adam before he fell. So Adam, when he fell, was not coerced or dragged into that sin. There were no internal forces compelling him to the sin. The decree which God had given concerning the fall of man did not, quote-unquote, force Adam to his sin, and neither had God implanted within Adam any program of internal coercion. So there was nothing that came to life at some point and said, now it's time to go sin. So, here's the question. How can a non-coercive decree still be a sovereign decree? Or how can a non-coercive decree be a decree? The answer to that question resides in the fact that the causal agent in sovereign decrees does not inhabit the same universe as the thing caused. God is not a resident of this cosmos. He's not a resident in this universe contained by it. Now, he's omnipresent within it. He is immanent within the creation. He's everywhere present, but he's also transcendent. He's beyond it. There's a creator-creature distinction or divide. So the sovereign decrees are not made from within the system. If sovereign decrees inhabited the same universe as the thing caused, then the causation on the one hand displaces responsibility on the other. In other words, if the cosmos is just a great big billiard ball table and every atom is a billiard ball and God is the giant cue or the giant ball within the system that strikes the other balls, then what's happening is a displacement of liberty. So you have movement or motion from one colliding with the other and displacing the other. Or to change the illustration, God is to the universe what Shakespeare is to Macbeth, and not what Lady Macbeth is to Macbeth. Lady Macbeth is one character in the play acting on another character in the play. When Shakespeare acts, it's not one character acting on another character. Put another way, God's relation to the universe is unlike every causal situation in the world that we know. The fact that God determined how everything would go does not mean that he forced it the way we would have to force it to make something like this happen. So if I put my iPhone on the table and I push it over and I say, okay, I'm going to decree that it be pushed a foot over, and then I slide it over, I'm causing it to slide to that position by means of particular causal actions that I'm familiar with. I understand how they work. I understand how they go. God's decree that the phone would be there at that particular time is not that kind of causal agent. All right, so the fact that God determined how everything would go does not mean that he forced it the way we would have to force it in order to make something happen. So, but note that here, the Westminsterian position, the Reform position on the human will is that in the creation, God gave it natural liberty. This chapter is entitled Of Free Will. So there is a Calvinistic or Reformed or Westminsterian doctrine of free will. Now, there is another competing definition of free will that the Arminians have, and that is the idea that free will does not exist unless you have the power of contrary choice, unless it really does have a question mark hovering over it. So that definition of free will is one that we deny, but The fact that we deny that definition of free will doesn't mean that we don't have our own definition of free agency or free will. So, continuing the illustration of Shakespeare and Macbeth, if you're watching a scene from Macbeth and Macbeth has just said, you know, history is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. So Macbeth just says that. And you're sitting in your seat looking at that. And you ask yourself, now, how much of that speech was Macbeth? And how much of it was Shakespeare? Well, that kind of formulation makes no sense. It was 100% Macbeth, and it was 100% Shakespeare. Shakespeare wrote the whole thing on a different plane than Macbeth occupied while saying it. Right. So God occupies the level of Shakespeare, and we occupy the level of Macbeth, or the characters in the play. Now, someone's going to say, oh, that's too cute or too glib, but that's, I'm a three-dimensional person. I'm real. Macbeth is a fictional character. Hamlet is a fictional character, so you can't compare the two. I'm much greater than Macbeth. I'm real. Macbeth is a fictional character. But it's interesting. I've used this illustration for many years, and over the years, no one has ever rushed up to me and said, Doug, your illustration doesn't hold. God is much, much greater than Shakespeare. Right? Nobody notices that if the illustration falls apart, it falls apart there. I'm closer to Macbeth. I'm closer to Hamlet than God is to Shakespeare. And that what that means is that God has the capacity to write a story where he writes 100% of the story, and at the same time, the story is occupied by and populated by creatures with genuine moral responsibility and free will. Now, someone's going to say, I can't make the math work on that. I can't make the math work. And the good news is neither can I. If we could make the math work on things like that, we'd all be richer than we are. We'd be, because we'd be much, much smarter than we are. So, but notice that we don't demand make the math work for other, like at Christmas time, we don't say, well, I can't believe in the incarnation. How can an infinite God become a finite man? I can't make the math work. Or how could God create the planet Jupiter out of nothing, ex nihilo, out of nothing? I can't make the math work. Well, that's quite true. This is a religion, after all, and we're talking about God, and we're talking about someone who can do things that we can't comprehend or imagine. And so, consequently, I would just give it a rest. The Bible teaches us what to believe, and we let God do the accomplishment of it. So, God's action on the world is unlike our actions on the world. We are creatures acting upon creatures, and to the extent that I act on someone, if I push someone, my exercise of my sovereign power displaces his free will. But God is not constrained by those issues at all. He can see to it before the foundation of the world that I'm standing on the corner of 3rd and Main at this time, at a particular time this afternoon, and that I got there entirely by my own free will, and entirely because I wanted to go there, I wanted to be there. So the more Shakespeare writes, the freer Hamlet gets. The more Shakespeare writes, the more Macbeth does. The more God writes a story for me, the more I do in that story. And it's not 50-50, it's not 90-10, it's not 99-1, it's 100%, 100%. God does 100% of what I do, and I do 100% of what I do, in different ways, on different levels, for different purposes, for different ends. So, paragraph 2. Man, in his state of innocency, had freedom and power to will and to do that which was good and well-pleasing to God, but yet mutably, so that he might fall from it. So Adam did not sin by any necessity that was related to how he had been created, In other words, Adam had the full ability, the full capacity to do right. He had everything he needed to do right. But this ability was no guarantee that he would in fact do right. He was created with a capacity for sin. That's important to note. Adam was created with a capacity to sin, a capacity to fall away. He was not created with a necessity to sin. Neither was he created with a necessity to do the right thing. He was created with the ability to go left or right. He was created with the ability to obey what God said about the fruit or to disobey what God said about the fruit. He could go either way. So, paragraph 3. Man, by his fall into a state of sin, hath wholly lost all ability of will to any spiritual good accompanying salvation, so as a natural man, being altogether averse from that good and dead in sin, is not able by his own strength to convert himself or to prepare himself thereunto. All right, so at this point in the our proceedings, we have to distinguish between physical liberty and moral liberty. Physical liberty and moral liberty. Physical liberty means the ability to turn left or right, to raise one's hand or lower it, to choose chocolate or vanilla. Moral liberty means the ability to choose the right course of action and to do so for the right reasons. Men as creatures still have physical liberty, even though it's after the fall, even though Adam fell into sin, we still have the physical liberty that we used to have. But as sinners, we have lost all moral liberty in Adam. The relation between physical liberty and the sovereignty of God presents an interesting philosophical problem, which should be addressed in accordance with the discussion above in paragraph 1. So, how can God determine before all worlds that I will scratch my head in this particular way at this particular time? Well, that's a question of physical liberty. I can hold my hand out and say I'm going to scratch my head or not, and I have the liberty to do it or not. And I could scratch it and then put my hand back and then not scratch it. I can go either way, and I can test myself, watch myself being able to go either way. And I know that God, before the world was created, determined which one of those things I would do, to illustrate my point. That has to do with physical liberty. Adam had physical liberty before the fall, and Adam had physical liberty after the fall. Any man who can stand up and walk around the room has that kind of liberty. Any man who can stand at a crossroads and decide to go down the road to the left or the right has that kind of liberty. That's physical liberty, and there's a philosophical problem relating the sovereignty of God to that liberty. But the loss of moral liberty presents no problem whatever. The reason we have a philosophical problem with physical liberty is because we are asserting that we do in fact have physical liberty, and that God does in fact ordain whatsoever comes to pass. So how do we harmonize those two things? Because I'm asserting both. But someone says, so how do you do that with moral liberty? And I say, well, there's no problem at all. The question there is not how to reconcile God's sovereignty in salvation with our liberty, because at this point, Calvinists, Reformed, Westminsterians deny that we have liberty there. There's nothing to harmonize. There's nothing to reconcile. We do not have any such liberty. There is nothing there to reconcile. We do not assert liberty. In fact, we assert slavery. Man is dead in his trespasses and sins. Man is a slave to sin, as Paul says. And so we don't have to explain how it can coexist with what God does. We are no more able to choose good than a pig can choose to fly. So Spurgeon was once asked how he reconciled divine sovereignty with human responsibility. And he said, well, I don't. I never reconcile friends. What he was talking about there is, I'm a moral agent. I can go left or right. I can make choices. And God is sovereign over all of it. God's sovereignty and my liberty are friends. They're not adversarial. They're not mutually exclusive. In fact, in chapter 3 of the Westminster, in paragraph 1, it says God doesn't destroy secondary causes by his foreordination of all things, but rather our liberty is established by his sovereignty. So I assert in the strongest possible way that I am a free agent walking around in this world, and God is absolutely in control of it, and there's nothing there to harm. There are two things there that need to be harmonized and which do in fact harmonize. But I don't, before I'm converted, I don't have moral liberty. I don't have the capacity to choose what is right. Because, why? Because I'm dead in sin. I'm a carcass. I'm a dead body. I'm a slave. So we consequently have no moral power. Before we are converted, we have no moral power. And this means we cannot convert ourselves, and we cannot prepare ourselves to be converted. We cannot prepare ourselves to be converted by God. I can't put myself in the right position for lightning to strike. If I just get to this spot, then lightning will strike me. I don't contribute anything. In this regard, we do absolutely nothing. Man as creature is free. So man as creature is free. We have as much natural liberty to go left or right as Adam did. Man as creature is free. We can go left, Adam could go left. We can go right, Adam could go right. The fall did not rob us of our creaturely liberty. The fall did ensure the loss of our ability to choose what is right for the right reasons. Man as creature is free. Man as sinner is not. Man as creature is free. Man as sinner is not. So man as sinner, does not become morally free until after regeneration. So he's dead in his trespasses and sins, and God raises him to life again. It's a unilateral action that God performs. It's called monergistic. God alone is the one who works. So in a monergistic act, God touches the sinner comes to life, that regeneration creates moral liberty. So you are not born again so that you could repent and believe. Rather, you don't repent and believe so that you can become born again. You are born again so that you can repent and believe. And God gives the gift of regeneration that creates the moral liberty with which a person chooses to repent and chooses to believe. So paragraph 4. When God converts a sinner and translates him into the state of grace, he freeth him from his natural bondage under sin, and by his grace alone enables him freely to will and to do that which is spiritually good. Yet so, as that by reason of his remaining corruption, he doth not perfectly, nor only, will that which is good, but doth also will that which is evil. So after a man is converted, moral liberty is restored, but not completely and immutably restored. In other words, we are still capable of sin, and further, we are not capable of complete and final perfection. The complete and final perfection that we will enjoy after the resurrection, the final perfection that we will enjoy in heaven, is still in our future. But the good that we do is truly and genuinely good. Because it is not perfect, it cannot be considered as the ground of our justification before God, but it is nonetheless genuine. So in a converted man, God restores moral liberty. That man therefore has the capacity to choose what is right that he didn't have before. He also continues to have the capacity to choose wrong, and he still struggles with that. He's not finally and completely perfect. So then, the last paragraph in this chapter is paragraph 5. The will of man is made perfectly and immutably free to do good alone in the state of glory only. All right? We're free to do good alone in the state of glory only. True freedom is found in heaven, where we choose what is right and can do no other. Once you're in heaven, you can't sin. Just try. Right? Once you're in heaven, once you're in glory, your position is secure. You can't do anything outside the will of God. Freedom is therefore not defined as the power of contrary choice, as the Arminians want to define it, but rather as the freedom to do nothing but right. By the former definition, God himself is not free and therefore is not a moral agent. If the power of contrary choice is essential to the identity of a moral being, then God is not a moral being, and we will not be moral in heaven. So if someone says, well, if someone insists that you have to have the power of contrary choice, where you can do the sinful thing or do the righteous thing, and if you don't genuinely have both options, then you're a puppet, you're not a true moral agent, then that means that in heaven we're all puppets because we're finally completely sanctified and glorified. It also means that God is not a moral agent because God cannot sin. God cannot lie. God cannot be tempted. God cannot fall into sin. It's contrary to his nature and character. But surely it sounds odd. Surely that should strike us as fundamentally weird to say that the author and ground of all morality is not himself a moral being. Of course God is moral. He is morality. He is righteousness. He is holy. He's holy and cannot be anything else. He's righteous and cannot be anything else. So consequently, the definition of moral liberty as the power of contrary choice is I think far too glib. So this definition of the power of contrary choice would make heaven nothing but an eternal moral prison. But the latter definition, the power of doing right, the freedom to do what is right and to flow in that direction only, that definition shows us where true freedom resides. By way of summary, wrapping this chapter up, this is a good place to introduce Augustine's famous fourfold distinction. This is Augustine, his fourfold distinction. 1, 2, 3, 4. Number one, libertas Adami. Okay? The liberty of Adam. The liberty of Adam. And this is posse non peccare, able not to sin. Okay? So before the fall, Adam was able to not sin. Adam could have said no to the temptation that confronted him. Posse non peccare, able not to sin. Number two, libertas peccatorum, non posse non peccare, not able not to sin, which is the condition of fallen man. So before you're converted, you are non posse non peccare, not able to not sin. Everything you do is sinning. Paul says in Ephesians 2 that we were dead in our trespasses and sins in which we used to walk. So everything about your life is sinful. Everything, the context is sinful. Even if you're not actively doing an act of wickedness right that moment, think of it this way. Before your conversion, you're sailing around on a pirate ship, you know, right? And you're not always raping and pillaging and burning other ships and sinking them and making people walk the plank. You're not always doing those evil deeds that are evil in high relief, but you are always on a pirate ship. You are always a pirate. What are you there for? What are you waiting to do? What are you ready to do? What's the function? So outside of Christ, outside of God, someone is always in a, they're always on the pirate ship. They're always sinning in some way, shape, or form because they're not submitted to God. And thus, they're not able to not sin. They can aggravate their sins. They can make their sins worse, but they can't zero it out to a sinless status. Number three, libertas fidelium, posse peccare et non peccare, able to sin and not sin. And this is the condition of the converted man. Posse peccare, able to sin, et non peccare, and not sin. So Christians are in this position. Truly converted people are in this position. They sadly know that they're capable of sin, but they also know that they're capable of resisting temptation and not sinning in a particular way. And then number four, libertas gloriae, non posse peccare, not able to sin, which will be our condition in glory. So, able not to sin, the condition of Adam, not able not to sin, the condition of the unconverted man, able to sin and not sin, the condition of the converted man, and then not able to sin, which is the condition of the glorified man. And surely it would be odd for us to be yearning for the day of redemption, yearning for the manifestation of the sons of God, at which time we will all become puppets. If that would be truly odd.
New St. Andrew's College thanks you for listening.